Welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman, and I'm your host. In today's program, the FCC blows a wet kiss to Zell Miller and the Tribune Company and opens the floodgates for TV newspaper combinations. Of course, far more than that happened this year. John Anderson from DIYmedia.net is in the studio with me to do part two of the big 2007 year-end wrap-up. You do want to stay tuned. You're back.
Yeah, you know, I think we need three shows.
You think we need three? You're not going to be here the following Friday, are you?
I know. No, I won't, but...
You do a phoner.
Yeah, we could do a phoner. There's just so much stuff that's happened in 2007. It's hard to cover in just an hour.
Well, it's been a big year, and on top of it being a big year, I mean, so much more... Congress has paid a lot more attention, I think, to these issues, even if they can't actually get anything to the floor for a vote. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we've seen such a big increase in the ability for public interest groups, whether it's the Consumer Federation of America or Public Knowledge or Free Press or the MoveOn.org to activate people around media issues. I mean, mm-hmm. we're seeing a real... I hope it's not the peak. I hope it's another stop on the rise.
No, this
here is
still a momentum building time.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But whether it's been net neutrality, which we haven't seen action on, but we've seen a lot more awareness of this whole year, especially with regard to Comcast being caught red-handed, interrupting peer-to-peer BitTorrent traffic, or whether it was Verizon blocking text messages.
Or T-Mobile blocking Twitter. Access.
Yes, that's a new one that just came down the wire today. Twitter.
Lots of evidence building up. And in fact, some of the people that support network neutrality in Congress do plan to introduce some sort of pro-net neutrality legislation to formally put the concept back on the law books sometime in early 08. But again, you know, that's a promise, and we'll see if they follow through.
Yeah, exactly. And then just a few days ago, on the 18th of December, as we go to air here, the FCC blew that big wet kiss, the one that we were all expecting in a party line 3-2 vote, getting rid of the newspaper TV cross-ownership ban affecting the top 20 markets in the United States, but with the pretty much the wink and the nudge that they'll be open to seeing to handing out waivers for many more markets below the top 20.
Yeah, well, as part of actually passing this cross-ownership ban, and it is effectively a ban on a repeal of the ban on cross-ownership of broadcast stations and newspapers in every market, not just the top 20 or 40 markets. As a part of actually passing this rule, the FCC also passed something like 40 waivers. There were all these pending waivers from all these media companies wanting to own a newspaper and a television station or a newspaper and a radio station in the same market. And as part of adopting this rule, they gave them all these waivers anyway. So that was the first big wet kiss, as you like to call it. The second one was the fact that the way that Kevin Martin wrote this newspaper cross-ownership ban modification, it basically leaves enough loopholes that effectively there can be cross-ownership in any media market. There's certain metrics, like if it doesn't involve one of the most four top popular, the combination of two of the four most popular TV stations and the most popular newspaper, then it can go through. There's all these weird caveats that effectively allow a company to make cross-owned properties in markets across the country. And in fact, and this should tell you something about the extent of Kevin Martin's wiliness, he actually met in the day or two before having this vote with members of the public interest community who pointed out the opportunity for potential loopholes in this rule that he was promulgating. And in the last day before actually voting on the rule, Kevin Martin redrafted it to include the suggested loopholes, which the public interest advocates were advocating that he not allow.
Yeah, I mean...
That's how screwed up this process was.
on top of that, I mean, the simple fact is that, right, that this was under constant revision. I mean, at no point did the public or even other commissioners have an opportunity to really review and provide comment on what would eventually become the policy as passed.
They voted at their meeting started at 10:30 in the morning on December 18th. According to one of the Democratic commissioners, it was either Copps or Adelstein. I can't remember from the statement, but you can go look it up on FCC.gov. 9:44 p.m. the night before is when their offices received what was supposedly the final draft of what they were going to be voting on 13 hours later. And we still don't know. We're still not quite sure because the order itself hasn't actually been published what the actual language that was adopted is.
Right. And so already we've heard from the Media Access Project.
Lawsuit is in the works.
They're just waiting for the final language to be published. And I heard that they're sort of willing to wait a little bit to see if a bill can go through Congress to reverse it. They'll give Congress a brief amount of head start on it. And if it doesn't look likely, they're going to go ahead and file.
Yeah, there are actually three interesting things which Congress is considering doing in reaction to this FCC decision. The first one is what they did last time this went through in 2003. The Senate, Byron Dorgan especially, is suggesting that he's going to put forward what they call a resolution of disapproval, which is basically a formal rebuke from Congress to the FCC for doing this. Then we saw the day after the FCC's meeting, bipartisan introduction of companion legislation in both the House and the Senate called the Media Ownership Act of 2007, which would effectively repeal what the FCC did on the cross-ownership issue. And the third and most interesting possibility is the potential for a formal scrutiny, overhaul, and reorganization of the FCC in 2008. Several lawmakers, especially those that have appropriations power over the Department of Commerce, are basically saying the FCC is broken, it needs to be fundamentally overhauled, and this decision is basically the cherry on top of the icing on the cake that justifies the need for an FCC overhaul. And basically, anytime an agency gets taken to the legislative woodshed, it's going to disrupt business as usual, you know, and I think that would be very interesting to see. And it's very possible that it could happen in an election year, because as some of the folks that actually cover telecom issues inside the Beltway have pointed out, if it's actually conducted in an election year, it somewhat depoliticizes the reorganization issue. You can actually say that it's something that we're undertaking as a bipartisan effort. It's not just the Democrats trying to do something to, you know, stump on in November. It actually, there's a better possibility for an overhaul of the FCC to happen in an election year than in a non-election year. So there's a lot of ways Congress could go with this. And then, of course, as you mentioned, the Media Access Project is considering filing a lawsuit. I think it might actually be in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which I find to be very interesting.
Since they did the Third Circuit on the last lawsuit.
Right, they got the lawsuit out of D.C., which I thought really helped the success of the lawsuit itself. So the fact that they're actually considering going directly to the D.C. Circuit makes me wonder exactly, you know, what the success potential of a lawsuit might really be.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they're certainly going to attack it from the standpoint of having not been sufficiently justified.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going to be the way they're going at it, because really nothing in the justification has changed. Nothing in the research has changed since 2003. Nothing substantial.
And that's
seeing the same case being presented and passed.
Yeah. And this is the funny thing is that a lot of the research that was done as part of this media ownership study didn't have anything to do with cross ownership.
No.
You know, I think of the 10 studies, one possibly had something to do with cross ownership. And so.
And that's why the industry's ticked off.
Right.
Because they're saying, wait a second, we wanted more television combinations and radio
combinations. You know, it's very important. We need it. I mean, the Clear Channel has been bugging the FCC both with formal comments and by lobbying commissioners directly ex parte style to basically get rid of all the radio ownership caps. You know, they
it's
want
like a little
that.
Shop of horrors.
Yeah.
Feed me.
It's crazy. But there's one person that actually made a really good point. There's obviously been an avalanche of coverage about this whole decision. But there's one person who I thought really made an interesting point, and that's Art Brodsky at Public Knowledge. Mm-hmm. He wrote a post on the Public Knowledge's blog the following day, December 19th, and he said that even though they weren't specifically involved in the fight over media ownership, they were happy to see that a lot of their allies, like Free Press and the Media Access Project and Prometheus, were. However, the whole concept of media ownership is something that actually goes above and beyond traditional media and is something that is still in play at the FCC, even though this monumentous vote has taken place. And they actually quoted from the three Republican commissioners. They quote from Martin, who says, "We cannot ignore the fact that the media marketplace is considerably different than it was when the cross-ownership rule was put in place. Back then, cable was a nascent service. Satellite television didn't exist. And there was no internet." Deborah Taylor Tate, the other Republican: "Throughout this process, I was struck by the ongoing dramatic changes in how Americans use the media to receive news, information, and entertainment. The internet has been transformed into a viable platform for streaming full-length video programming." Robert McDowell, Republican FCC commissioner: "Mark Twain warned us over a century ago, if you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you do read the newspaper, you are misinformed. Of course, Mr. Twain had no other media than newspapers at his fingertips to glean information. The 21st century's chaotic explosion of information from broadcast radio and television, cable TV, satellite radio and TV, the internet, and many other voices and outlets would have given Twain an ocean of material to use to skewer his targets with the satire. Without question, however, he would have had a blog, and I'm sure if he were alive today, it probably would have been one of the most popular blogs on the internet." Now, you can see where I'm going here. All the common themes of the justification that the Republicans used to allow this cross-ownership ban to be repealed is the internet. The internet provides all this wonderful diversity of information. And Art Brodsky's point is that the FCC is also in charge of overseeing the consolidation that's taken place in the telecommunications sector, a broadband provision and penetration.
Bell South, AT&T,
and Comcast and Verizon, the big three. I mean, it is media consolidation in another form, and these are open issues which the FCC will continue to consider in the next year and beyond. And so what Art Brodsky's doing is calling out the Republican commissioners and saying, okay, you've justified using the internet as a reason to repeal some media ownership rules dealing with traditional media. Now, will you preserve the internet's open access policies, which have created the diversity which you cite? And well, you know, it remains to be seen whether they will or not.
I'll get a link to that put up on the Media Geek page as soon as the show's over here today. Yeah. And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at all the grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. I'm Paul Rizzonello, and I'm your host today. It's the second part of our big 2007 wrap-up. With me is John Anderson with DIYmedia.net. He's also a doctoral student at the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and a frequent writer about radio issues, especially and looking at digital radio, radio policy, and unlicensed radio, which we're going to get to in a moment. And you can check out Media Geek online at the Media Geek website, which is MediaGeek.net. That's the blog. If you want to get the program, it's at radio.mediageek.net. You can download the MP3, the Ogvorbis file. You can subscribe to the podcast, get automatically downloaded to your computer MP3 player. And now I've also got a little player embedded there, so you don't even have to do that. You can just click play in your browser.
Flash is wonderful.
I'm getting all 21st century, finally.
Web 2.0.
And so I'm pushing Web 3.0.
All right.
We're moving to Web 3.0. If you got any comments, send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. All right, let's shift gears here. So we're going to get and take a look at what the FCC's been doing about unlicensed broadcasting, which hasn't gone away. We don't
pirate radio.
You don't hear about it in the news so much. So those pop up here and there in local reports when there's a particularly prominent station.
There was a big problem in Boston a couple months ago where a pirate station interfered with one air traffic control frequency. That made national news. That was huge. But yeah, you're right. It hasn't been in the news very much.
It hasn't been a big national story in a while.
No.
But that doesn't mean there haven't been unlicensed stations. And it doesn't mean that the FCC hasn't been keeping busy tracking them down.
No, actually, if the FCC stays on pace throughout the rest of the year, the remainder of 2007, they will be able to claim, at least, that they conducted one enforcement action against pirate radio station per day. In 2007.
That's a That sounds...
On average, they conducted one enforcement action per day. That sounds like, you know, they're just going gangbusters,
right? That
sounds like
an increase.
Yeah, it's a massive increase. I mean, the number of enforcement actions that have been taken against pirate radio stations as of December 14th, 2007, is 354. Last year's total was 292. In 2005, the total was 152. So in a span of 2 years, we have seen a doubling of the number of enforcement actions taken against unlicensed microbroadcasters in the United States. One interesting trend that's come out of this, this year's data specifically, there's two. The first one is that what we consider to be the pirate radio capital of the United States, at least from an enforcement action perspective, is no longer South Florida. It's actually the New York City metropolitan area with a pretty lively satellite scene happening in New Jersey. That is where the FCC has been issuing the most warning letters, conducting the most visits, doing the most notices of apparent liabilities, which are the we're going to fine you warning letters, and then actually issuing forfeitures.
And New Jersey is a state law making unlicensed broadcasting a crime.
Yes, it's a misdemeanor there, I think.
It's just a misdemeanor there.
But the local authorities and state authorities in New Jersey, unlike in Florida, they have not been enforcing this rule. Okay. The FCC is the one that is still actually going out and going after these pirates and going through the enforcement protocol with them. So that's a shift. We've seen a lot more activity in the New York metropolitan area, New Jersey, as opposed to South Florida. That doesn't mean that South Florida isn't going gangbusters because it is. And the second thing is that the significant number of today's microbroadcasters are operating to serve what I guess I'd call ethnically identifiable audiences. These are specific populations, typically immigrant populations.
Who are underserved by the local
who
media.
Are not even underserved,
not
are so far off the radar of the mainstream media as to be effectively invisible. And a lot of these stations tend to run commercially. They support local businesses in their neighborhoods and their communities. Some stations, especially in the New Jersey area, are run as adjuncts to other businesses like a nightclub or an audio video electronics store or a car, a stereo store or something like that. And that is a trend, and that is a type of microbroadcasting that has not been incredibly prevalent in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But these things are happening. Now, if you look at the number of enforcement actions, it seems like the FCC is going nuts and, enforcement's going crazy and they've declared war on pirates. But you have to take into consideration several points of information here. The first one is that the database that I keep collects data points on enforcement activity. So, for example, this year in Milwaukee, a man was issued a $10,000 notice of apparent liability. This came after the FCC visited his station four times in 2005, twice in 2006, and issued a warning letter also in 2006.
So are you counting each of those as an action?
Each of those would count individually in my database. So that's like eight data points for one station, mm-hmm. right? And that inflates the perception of the enforcement activity that's taking place. Another thing that I've noticed is the FCC has made it pretty standard procedure to issue warning letters to anybody and everybody they think may be attached to a radio station. So that might mean one or more individuals. It also means the person who owns the property the station operates from. So in that case, if you have two people running a pirate station renting from an office complex, the FCC issues three warning letters, and I count all of those as three separate data points, right? But it's all one station. Now, if you wanted to manually count the number of parties actually affected by the FCC this year, feel free. I have all the data up on my website. I don't have the time or energy to do that. I would guess that the number of parties affected is somewhere north of 100.
Okay.
354 enforcement actions. But if you consider each station roughly gets three contacts, I'm just guesstimating
but
here.
But still, that's 100 unlicensed stations.
That are operating that have been caught, have been on the FCC's radar. And if we go by, like Stephen Dunifer has said this before, the 10% rule, in that if you really think about it, 10% of the stations are the ones that get caught or get noticed. The other ones are pretty much all underground and go, invisible, except for the people that they serve, of course. Mm-hmm. That means, if we apply that rule to this, there's more than 1,000 micro radio stations on the air around the United States. And the types of enforcement activity that the FCC is engaged in is not any more serious than it has been in previous years.
Because we really haven't seen many raids.
No.
We haven't seen the federal marshals called
up. You can count the number of station raids against pirate stations in 2007 on one hand.
So there have been some.
There have been five.
Okay.
Most of these have been conducted in South Florida by state and local officials.
Okay.
The FCC itself has not actually engaged the federal marshals. These have mostly been local enforcement actions.
And that's typically an action they reserve for the most sort of audacious,
right,
shall we say.
And longest running and egregious, willful, right, and repeated violators. So they haven't been applying the police military style muscle. And when it comes to actually escalating things beyond we're going to warn you or we're going to knock on your door and intimidate you, the FCC really hasn't gone any further with that either. 13 fines were issued this year. 11 warning fines, otherwise known as notices of apparent liability, were issued this year. That's 24 fiscal penalties plus the five raids equals less than 10% of all FCC enforcement action.
So that means that three quarters of the stations have gotten by without any of those penalties.
Right, and more than 90% of the FCC's enforcement activity in 2007 against pirate radio stations has been purely administrative.
So really, nothing much has changed.
No, the FCC is still a paper tiger, and if you go by the theory like I do that the increased amount of enforcement, you know, correlates to an increased amount of activity, these numbers are very heartening because it means that micro radio is alive and well and possibly stronger than it has ever been.
And changing and evolving.
And changing.
Because we're seeing, I mean, many more of these stations serving these unserved communities. Mm-hmm. And it seems like one of the reasons that those little ones being busted more frequently is that they're probably operating in a fashion they're used to operating in other countries, mm-hmm, where there's even less enforcement and it's much more of a wink and a nod. And they're, you know, if they're doing advertising, they're not clandestine. They're
right,
easy to find.
Right.
They're not, you know, really hiding. They're hiding right out in the open.
Now, the interesting thing is some, if not all, of these cases of pirates that have been serving what I call ethnically identifiable communities, all of them that have actually been fiscally penalized, you know, given $10,000 or $17,000 fines, have in almost every case appealed those fines down to something below $1,000, $250, $500, $750, because the FCC has to take into consideration the person's ability to pay.
Financial hardship.
Right. And most of these people are broke or poor. They can supply 3 years worth of tax returns that show that they don't have jack. So the FCC is statutorily mandated to decrease the fine to something that they can possibly pay, $250, $750, $1,000, $500. And you can bet in cases like that, the gear moves to another person,
oh, yeah,
who starts the station back up, makes advertising income, and covers the fine.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's ineffective. The FCC's, even their administrative escalation, they've gone from visiting a week's turnaround from visiting a pirate station to issuing a warning letter. You know, in some cases in the New York area, they've escalated from a visit to a notice of apparent liability in a month.
Wow, that's really fast.
That's really fast for the FCC's, pace. But is it actually having a substantive deterrent effect on people going on the air? The answer is no.
Because, and if you look at South Florida, even making it a crime, even making it a felony in that state, doesn't seem to have had a significant deterrent effect either.
No, and we also have to remember that as of so far that we know, no one has been successfully convicted under Florida's anti-pirate law. One person was brought, was charged, but pled down to a lower charge that wasn't a felony. And there are some cases supposedly working their way through the state justice system. But the fact that they're not actually going forward makes me wonder if the state of Florida is second guessing whether or not they have the legal authority to, you know, the jurisdictional authority to regulate their own airwaves.
Or, yeah, it may be that the local prosecutors just simply have more
too
important
much stuff
things
to worry about.
They're dealing with murderers, yeah, and rapists and robberies and crimes that have actual victims.
Right.
And when faced with putting a lot of time and effort into one of these pirate radio cases, it may not be getting the top billing in their docket.
Yeah.
It seems to me that, increasingly what we're seeing is that unlicensed radio is a lot lot like, you know, marijuana consumption.
Or speeding. Yeah, you're right.
Or speeding. I mean, increasingly what we're seeing is that, sure, you know, if you are a recreational drug user, you know, you run a risk. You run a risk of getting caught through the purchase, through the use, or whatever else. Obviously, the more flagrant you are, the greater you go up. But that the vast majority of people who use recreational drugs clearly aren't being caught and clearly aren't being put into prison. It's only a very small percentage who it's happening to. And I think we may be even seeing with pirate radio, there seems to be skewing towards minorities. I think minorities, partially, you know, at least in Florida and New Jersey, because these are the folks who maybe are more visible in using unlicensed radio.
Not only that, but you know, when you're left with no other alternatives, as you know, if you've reached a critical mass in your own neighborhood or your community, right, and you have no way to communicate within that community, sometimes you have to take extra legal steps in order to organize and you know, function. And as you've mentioned, some of these pirate operators, especially in South Florida, come from places like the Caribbean, where there is a very active pirate radio scene, and they already have the skills to put these stations on the air. And so there's that going on. But yeah, I mean, if the mainstream media or even the alternative media, which is primarily white and middle class, yep, in most places, is not serving these communities, the evidence shows that these communities will take it upon themselves to serve themselves. And I think that that is a really strong a positive notion for the essence of micro radio and what it's supposed to stand, right, for. It might not be as explicitly political as it has been in the 90s, where the stations go on the air with the electronic middle finger and specifically talk about how they're flagrantly violating the FCC's rules, you know, on ethical grounds, yeah, and things like that.
Civil disobedience.
But it's still an explicitly political act because they know it's against the law, right, and they're willing to run the risks. And basically, the risk assessment is the key. And if more people are assessing the risks and going on the air, then that has to be a heartening sign.
Well, and they can't get low power stations in these places.
Not
New
yet.
Jersey, New York, right? Not yet, but still. I mean, in a lot of ways.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that there have actually been a couple of cases of AM and shortwave enforcement this year, which is something that we haven't seen in several years. There's one case of at least someone in New Jersey running an unlicensed AM radio station on 1700 kilohertz, which, wow, is part of the expanded
band. It's unusual that the FCC is paying attention to,
yeah,
those stations.
And there was also a case of someone in Taylorville, Illinois, who was running an unlicensed broadcast operation on two shortwave frequencies.
Now, was this continuous? Is this sort of, because most shortwave broadcasts tend to,
yeah,
be kind of on the hit and run side.
This is someone who publicized his activity on the internet, mm-hmm, and basically made himself into a target. Also, did not conduct himself in a spectrally responsible way. Sometimes stepped on that. You're supposed to share frequencies, especially, right, on the shortwave dial, because there's a limited number of frequencies that pirates can use. And this guy wasn't sharing very well, so he's been busted as well. But yeah, I mean, the activity is across all bands, and there is FCC enforcement data this year to show that this activity is taking place across all bands.
All right, John, thanks. Your website is DIYmedia.net, where people can check out the Enforcement Action Database themselves. And you have a post up there right now digesting a lot of this information so people can go and delve in. And maybe if someone wants to go through and really do the math and figure out exactly
how
many stations and operators have been contacted.
Feel free.
Someone who's got an extra night on their hands. That would be wonderful. DIYmedia.net. Thanks again, John.
Thank you.
That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. KQRP in Salida, California. KRBS in Oroville, California. WSLR in Sarasota, Florida. WTND, Macomb, Illinois. WRFA in Jamestown, New York. CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia. WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia. KWMD, Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska. WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont. And Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.